Yes.
Okay, so I want to give the word to you about, we start with the relation to quantum gravity, and in particular is the approach that is pioneered maybe by Professor Lorentz, and what it has, and the possible relation with conformity.
thank you, Tim. Thank you for the invitation, organizers, and for the honor of giving the first talk at this meeting. So clearly the word conformal had to appear in the talk title. So here we go, conformal aspects of quantum gravity and CDT for the uninitiated. That is an approach to non-perturbative quantum gravity. I've been working on causal dynamical triangulations. So since I am the first, I will in part set the stage and maybe introduce some notions, which I'm sure will be popping up later on, that will occupy the first part of my talk. In particular, I will be also looking at a structure that keeps popping up. That's the Wheeler-DeWitt metric in a generalized form. So it has a new parameter, which I call little lambda, on whose role we'll hear more in my talk, how it helps us isolating conformal degrees of freedom from conformal geometry, and what we might be able to learn from it, perhaps for different theories of quantum gravity. Then I highlight associated then, an example of a possible pitfall that can arise when one tries to interpret this parameter. Then I talk a little bit about effective actions which one can try to extract from quantum gravity and CDT in particular, and also briefly how they relate to the phase diagram of CDT. And if time, now that's a big if, let me tell you what our attempts of going beyond the formal mode have resulted in so far. So my main aim is setting the stage and engendering a discussion of topics I'm sure will come back in subsequent talks. I should mention here my collaborators, long-standing Jan Ambion and Jurek Jurkiewicz, but I also really want to emphasize the input of the somewhat younger people. André Görlich is now a postdoc in Copenhagen. Timothy Butt is a former PhD student of mine since 2 months or so. Samuel Jordan is still working on his PhD with me, and Luis Pires is a master student who has just started his PhD with me. And also here, let me take the opportunity to advertise our newest summary of work that has been done in CDT that just has appeared on the archive and in Physics Report. Okay, let's get started by classical GR, some well familiar setting. Let me just summarize some of it for the purposes of today. So let me take a somewhat global look on this. Now, I'm interested in the structure, global and local, of the configuration space underlying pure GR. So I have already made a 3+1 split. So let me just look at the spatial metrics, GAB. They depend on the spatial X and some time parameters that came from my decomposition. For the purposes of now talking about three geometries, I'll often drop this T here. But it'll be back, don't worry. So this is an element of the space of Riemannian metrics on some three-manifold sigma, and then of course I have conjugate momenta, but let me not talk about this. Now, the point is I have two kinds of operations, actions that operate on these three metrics. Firstly, three-dimensional diffeomorphisms, and then also more relevant for the purposes of this conference, what I call pointwise conformal transformations. So let me look at orbits of either of these two group actions through any point G, a three metric G lying in this space of Riemannian metrics. So the orbit through some point metric G of the diffeomorphisms is just, metrics that are kind of displaced by, this is a pullback of phi, where phi is an arbitrary pseudomorphism. And of course, we regard metrics from the same equivalence class as physically equivalent, because all the metric properties are just identical. So they're indistinguishable from the point of view of the metric properties. Now, by contrast, I can also act on a given element G of my space with a pointwise conformal transformation like this. So this can be understood as a matrix multiplication. These are 3x3 symmetric matrices, the Gs. And this is just a positive function. That's why I call it e to the omega. So omega is just an arbitrary function of space. So let me call the space of this positive function is somewhat fancily at conf of sigma. So what is the kind of geometric situation? So I have here this big infinite dimensional space of the Riemannian matrix of sigma. Now here is some g. Of course, now I've considered orbits, say, under the action of this group, as a matter of fact, so through g. So all points here are obtained by multiplying them with some e omega, e to the omega multiplicative like this. So this is now a particular such orbit. And one orbit we sometimes call a conformal geometry. So the equivalence class under these local pointwise scale transformation is called a conformal geometry. So in particular, so an orbit is what is called a conformal geometry. Now, so this has elements acting. Of course, what you might attempt on top of that is to is something that's called a conformal decomposition. So roughly speaking, that means I take a given three metric and I decompose it kind of in a scale part and a rest. So schematically, I'd write it like this. GIB of x is e omega of x. And then I should fix kind of some distinguished class of metrics. For example, I can do that by requiring them to have a constant scalar curvature, which you can think of as a gauge choice in here. So that would be a gauge choice, which picks, which crosses each of these orbits exactly once. So then I get the full space by operating with these local scale transformations. Now note, of course, there is a difference physically speaking with the previous situation here of the diffeomorphism orbits. General relativity is not invariant under this type of scale transformation. So GR is not kind of conformally invariant in this sense I just introduced. So for one thing, of course, GR has natural dimension for constant, which do set a scale. So that's clearly one reason why it's not invariant. So in particular, of course, distinct points along such an orbit are not physically identified. Now, nevertheless, I mean, this type of decomposition often plays an important role. And I think, well, of course, will also play an important role in what is being talked at this conference here. So what are specific gravitational applications that in some way or other linked to this scenario kind of I just outlined? First of all, you might want to isolate this what's called the conformal mode sometimes. So that's calling a mode conformal doesn't mean too much in gravity, you see. So this we call the conformal mode, and these are the conformal geometric degrees of freedom, so the rest. So, so it covers a lot. And of course, it's also slightly sometimes confusing in the language people use what is meant. You might, of course, also consider situations which are approximately conformally invariant. So, for example, people have made arguments that perhaps in the cosmological context, either and or at late and or very early times, the universe might actually have some kind of scale invariance. So that's one point one can make. Or what we'll also certainly meet in this meeting is to rewrite GR that it in such a way that it does appear to be invariant under such transformation. Lastly, one can take kind of the opposite point of view. One can put oneself in a situation where one can argue kind of all the other modes away. So those here, and say, oh, let me consider a situation where everything is dominated by the physics of the conformal mode. There are various applications of that too. And you can also then, for example, think of that such a thing as a reduced quantum gravitational model, which you may just use to study your preferred way of quantizing gravity. Okay, now that brings me to topic number two, or the second point there on my list. Now, how does this generalized real De Witt metric come in, and what does it have to do with this conformal versus other degrees of freedom in gravity? So this is a generalized Wheeler De Witt metric. So what space is it a metric on? Is actually the space of all remaining three metrics, which I've just talked about. So of course, what does a metric do? So here is again rem sigma at any point G. Of course, remember, this is an infinite dimensional, this is a function space. At any point G, I can kind of take two tangent vectors and I can ask what their scalar product is. So these Wheeler De Witt metrics is a one parameter family actually gives me a natural diffeomorphism invariant way of defining a scalar product. So let me call kind of two tangent vectors del G, del G prime. Then now if I look at a specific, now this is a full function. These are full functions, so they have an x dependence. If I now look at a single point x, these are just symmetric two tensors, 3 by 3 two tensors. And this helps us to understand kind of what this De Witt metric is. So it has four indices to contract the indices on these two tensors, GAB, del GAB of x, del G prime CD of x. So at each point x, so this contracts the indices and it depends on the base point G. So that's where I'm looking at the tangent space of this infinite dimensional object. Now, more specifically, so what is G lambda as a function of G? It is the following algebraic expression, 1/2. Square root of determinant of G, GAC, GBD, plus GAD, GBC, minus 2 lambda GAB, GCD. So, and let me, because that is an object I'll be saying more about, let me just color code this in that way. So, see, it's quadratic here in the inverse matrix, plus has this determinantal factor here. Now, if I want, I mean, the genuine scalar product is, of course, I give you two such vectors, and I have an operation that produces a number. How do I get a number? Well, by integrating this expression, which still has an x dependence, over all of three space. Okay, then it will spit me out a number. So that's exactly, of course, what a metric does. Now, this is the most, so first of all, I said it has a nice property of being 3D diffeomorphism invariant. And it also has the property of being ultra-local. So only G itself, not derivatives of G, appear. And then one can show that this is actually the most general object one can write down. And it still has this one parameter dependence on some real parameter lambda here. Now, very interestingly, it's a metric. So you can ask, what is its signature? And it turns out that its signature, you know, in the sense of the signs of the eigenvalues when I diagonalize it, depends on the value of little lambda here. So in particular, how can one see this in a nice way? One can see it by using kind of adapted coordinates on the underlying space. That is, of course, Riemann sigma. And so one way of doing it is as follows. U, instead of using the GIBs of X, I go to a set of a function I call tau of X and a function I call G twiddle of X. Now, how are these defined? GAB twiddle is 1 divided by the determinant of G to 1 set GAB. And, well, you see that this is scale invariant, right? Because if I apply a transformation of this kind, well, we are in 3 dimensions, of course, then the factor that comes from here is exactly canceled by this denominator here. Now, what is tau? Is equal to C. So it's a determinant of the metric to some power, 1/4. And what is C? C is a number. C squared is equal to 16 modulus of lambda minus 1/3. So here our lambda makes an appearance. That's a 16. These are modulus signs. So this is just some positive number, C squared. This is a tau. So essentially, locally at an x, these are 6 numbers. This is 1 number, and these are 5 numbers. Right. So that's a decomposition in the space of symmetric 2 tensors, if you like, locally. But of course, it extends to the whole x-dependent object. So now, the nice property of this is that it makes the Wheeler-DeWitt equation kind of block diagonal. What do I mean by that? If I look at kind of the infinitesimal line element, G, A, B, C, D, lambda, del D, G, A, B, tensor product DGCD, then this becomes, in the new coordinates, it becomes signature sine of lambda minus 1/3. So this is plus minus 1 or 0 d tau tensor t tau plus another piece, tau squared divided by c squared, trace g twiddle minus 1 dg twiddle, tensor g twiddle minus 1 dg twiddle. So this here is a pure trace part, if you like. And this here just refers to these scale invariant degrees of freedom g twiddle. Yes. So it block diagonalizes the metric in this way. And you see here that depending on whether lambda is smaller, bigger, or equal to 1/3, this term either drops out or has a positive sign or a negative sign. This piece is manifestly positive. So what do we conclude here? So for lambda larger than 1/3, this is positive. So this picks up a minus sign, this first contribution. Then G has signature. If I now look at it, say, at a given point x, minus plus 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 plus. Conversely, if lambda is smaller than 1/3, then G has signature all positive. So this, I should mention, this particular way of presenting this is due to Domenico Giolini, 1995. But this is in principle old stuff, but I just want to present it to you here because we'll be using some of it. So that's the story of the De Witt metric and how what this lambda dependent does. So of course it raises the question, what is this lambda? Now, first of all, where does the De Witt metric appear when I do GR? It appears when I write down the kinetic term in the Hamiltonian of GR, right? Because there I contract exactly two momenta with this Wheeler-De Witt metric. So question is now, the natural metric that appears there belongs to which value of lambda? It corresponds to lambda equal to 1. So that's the GR value. Whatever. Now that entails, let's leave this open for the moment. It entails something that is at least in part unpleasant. It entails that the gravitational action is unbounded, unbounded below, that is. So that's a very unusual property for a physical system to have. So the gravitational action for me is just the Einstein-Hilbert action. So let us see how this comes about. So let me write this down. Einstein-Hilbert action just for lambda equal to 1. Of course, it depends on the metric. So I have here my Newton's constant in this prefactor 1 divided by 16 pi g Newton. And here I'm using kind of an ADM language. So I have a lapse here already. G refers to the 3 metric. And then what do I have here? Well, essentially a kinetic term. So where exactly the Wheeler-De Witt metric makes an appearance for the special value lambda equal to 1. So we have something that's quadratic. Essentially, in the case are the extrinsic curvatures. So they're like velocities in the sense of field configurations. And then I have a potential term. And I've just put a plus or minus, so that covers the Lorentzian and the Euclidean case. So of course, I have different relative signs for kind of kinetic versus potential terms. So this covers both cases. But the discussion here for this kinetic term is independent of the signature. So let me just point that out. So these are the extrinsic curvatures. Well, let me not write them down, but let me spell out how the nature of this metric now contributes to making this expression unbounded below. So let me just pick out this term quadratic in the extrinsic curvature K, KCD. Now, roughly speaking, well, for instance, I can choose proper time gauge. I just want to exhibit why this becomes negative and arbitrarily negative. So that's roughly speaking up to some constant is G lambda. Let me choose general lambda to start with here, A, B, C, D. And roughly speaking, these are, of course, the first derivatives, the time derivatives of metrics. So I have G, A, B dot, G, C, D dot. Now, if I imagine now some decomposition of this kind into conformal mode plus rest, what I find is, with some positive prefactors, I find a kinetic term for this omega that, well, up to some also density factors, which I'm not caring about, looks like this. So the omega dot squared is just what I expect, is a kinetic term, plus rest, so some prefactor, and then I have a G bar dot squared terms, of course, plus lots of other stuff. Yes. Now, for the lambda, the GR value, lambda is equal to 1, so this is minus 2, so this is negative, right? So for lambda equal to 1, this is just minus 6 omega dot squared. So this is manifestly negative. So it's very strange. It's a kinetic term, right? It's like, you know, quantum mechanics with a, instead of a q dot squared kinetic energy, I have a minus q dot squared. And of course, this can become arbitrarily large and negative if omega is highly oscillatory. Yes? So this is what makes both the Lorentzian and the Euclidean action for gravity unbounded below. Now, a potentially kind of disastrous consequence this could have for the Euclidean path integral. And that's, of course, a well-known story, but maybe worthwhile mentioning again. This suffers from what's called the conformal sickness, and this is exactly the divergence, the potential divergence associated with this term here, right? So one of the field degrees of freedom out of the six I have, I mean, superficially in the metric. Now, why is it a problem? Let me write down, this doesn't move as hard as I might try. So this is the Euclidean path integral, let me call it Z, depending on G Newton, and for generality, I put in a cosmological constant. Now, this is given as some formal integral over kind of four-dimensional metrics. Now, they live on four-dimensional space-time M, modulo four-dimensional diffeomorphisms M. And I imagine here in some way I have arranged to integrate over equivalence classes. Of course, this would usually be implemented by making some gauge choices. And up here, since I'm in Euclidean gravity, I have a minus S Einstein Hilbert of G. Now, see what happens if I stick in this action here. So it has this kinetic term, and in particular, it has this minus omega dot squared term. So this becomes, of course, an E, because of this minus sign, integral over plus omega dot squared, which can just grow unboundedly. So we are potentially in trouble with this. Now, of course, well, people have made the arguments, and me among them, is that, you know, hang on a minute, what is one computing here, or what is one's aim to compute here, is actually, you know, what possibilities do I have theoretically in the continuum? I gauge fix that, which means I make a coordinate change, for example, like I suggested up there. I integrate out, of course, all the diffeomorphisms. Then I'm left with kind of these conformal degrees of freedom, plus this, the omega, the conformal mode. But of course, in the process, I pick up a Jacobian, right? And the Jacobian looms here, so this is that, and it contributes, of course, to the action. So here I have my action written as a function of these reduced variables, G bar and omega. So what has been argued for by some people for some time is that, well, definitely this divergence is there, but it could be compensated under, if we are lucky, by contributions coming from this functional determinant. Now, this is an object that is impossible for us to evaluate in the continuum, really. So you would like to do this non-perturbatively. The question is, do we have any evidence that this can happen? And here, the point is, yes, we definitely have a class of models. And these are exactly kind of these dynamically triangulated or causally dynamical triangulated models, which are examples that under suitable circumstances, you might actually get contributions from here, which cancel this conformal sickness. Now, what could this be? What could this be interpreted as? Yes, yes.
This never bothered me. So
yes.
Yes. There is time deparametrization symmetry here,
yes,
still left over.
Yes.
So under that time deparametization symmetry, you
yes
are free to choose a pH. In particular, I can choose omega to do whatever I want.
Yes.
So it's not really a gauge, it's not really the degree of freedom. There is one less degree
yes
of freedom.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So you could eliminate this cost.
Yes.
You have the gauge symmetry to eliminate this cost. And so for that reason, it never really bothers me. And in fact, the constraint associated with that gauge symmetry is what is called the zero energy constraint.
Yes.
Right, which says that, in fact, that expression that you're looking at is actually zero.
Yes.
So you do need this negative term.
Yes.
If you don't have that negative term, you can have negative zero because everything else is positive.
Yes. So I completely agree with you. And most that's the standard attitude. Mm-hmm. Why bother? Even if I do it canonically, exactly what you say happens. So I have a constraint, and this will just fix this omega. So from that point of view, you could say, well, in whichever way I look at this path integral, I can't really do it. But things should conspire in such a way that I'm just cutting these orbits. So effectively, this integration should generate some effective gauge fixing for me. Yes, that's a Fadeyev Popov. That's what I mean. This is my functional determinant. So that subsumes all Fadeyev Popov determinants, indeed. Yes.
But even before that, yes. Even without involving time,
yes.
You still have a diffeomorphism invariance in three dimensions.
Yes.
In three dimensions, of course, I can use a gauge such that tau is 1. I can choose a coil such that the volume factor is constant. So, in other words, it looks like a gauge.
Yeah, but I still would have to evaluate the associated, and if I wanted to do the full series, that's also a way for say from the Petrov limit, I still would be faced with evaluating this and making explicit what you suggested ought to happen.
It's not to see explicitly how it goes, see that you can go through the complete canonical procedure, find that this is not a bug, it's a feature. They always say that if your computer breaks down everything, they say, no, it's supposed to break down.
Yes.
It's a feature, it's not a bug. And here, also, this is a fundamental thing in quantum gravity that ought to be there.
Perhaps, of course, let me now not dwell on the fact that, of course, the perturbative theory is intrinsically ill-defined when I come to asking questions at very high energies, which I want to. So let us consider this more general context. This is not the central. Maybe it is the central point. So here's a question.
Perhaps some more basic observations.
Yes.
First of all, I believe the object you're talking about is not the Dewitt supermetric, but the inverse Dewitt supermetric, which is the more conceptually correct one to be talking about because it's the GR configuration space metric.
Well, it depends on what my objects are, of course. As I coming from the path integral, you could argue which one is more. Which one is more relevant. If I exclude the case where I actually have degeneracies, of course, I can switch back and forth between the two.
But meaning the inverse of the Dewitt paper, the metric is taken to be the object in the Hamiltonian constraint, which is the inverse.
It is the inverse, absolutely. That's right, because of course the pi's have the indices upstairs. Yes, okay. Wrong.
Can we actually safely know what is the measure of that integral?
No.
Before we start?
No. This thing here? No. No.
So is this well defined even before we start?
Yes, yeah. Sure. So what I'm saying is, this conformal issue is one of the problems I have with making this well-defined. How it is entangled with all the other issues, clearly I will have to regularize and renormalize at the very least to make any sense of this. So these things are not easily entangled, of course, in any practical application. Yes.
Next, the points you're making about the unboundedness are not specific to lambda equals 1, but are specific to the cross.
That is completely correct.
That's worth pointing out. Because there are further features that do depend specifically on lambda equals 1 for GR. And also, in having lambda greater than a third and less than a third, you've not commented on the critical case that lies between the two.
Yes.
Where the metric is a null signature.
No, I haven't commented really on any of the cases apart from just pointing out what the properties of the metric are, the Dewitt metric. And one question, of course, arises in what is lambda? What is the meaning of lambda? And does it lead to distinguishable physics, or can I rule out some of these values, a priori, say, or by simple arguments? So that brings me exactly to the next point. So let me, however, very briefly, so what is the argument? What kind of argument could one make here if I'm able, if I only was able to compute this beyond perturbation theory, or even in perturbation theory, then I would be happy. Then probably, if I right now combine this here with the bare action, so to speak, to a combined effective action that would then govern, amongst other things, my quantum dynamics, I might pick up some kind of a lambda effective, right? So that's the idea, at least as far as this mode is concerned, that would make then this positive. So that's a more concrete way in which one might phrase the question. So does this mean we have some, you know, in the quantum theory, some lambda effective, which makes then the, this change sign? So let me just pose this as a question, because it has a somewhat more concrete character. Okay. But as I said, we have already a class of models where clearly some mechanism of that type is at work. Now we come to the potential pitfalls. I want to understand what the little lambda is. So, of course, my observation now that maybe somehow GR fixes it to be one leads me naturally to ask, now, if I have lambda not equal to one, popping up in some context where this reload emit metric makes an appearance, does this automatically mean that it's not GR, but something else, something that doesn't make any sense? And indeed, such a claim has been made. Let me just pick out one of the claims. So that is a paper that I was aware of for a long time by Giulini and Kiefer that came out in 1994, where they were just considering slightly generalized GR, where everything is like GR, in particular the Hamiltonian constraint and the Diffeo constraint, are exactly the same, apart from the fact that I relax the G1 to be a G lambda. So I get apparently a one parameter family of Hamiltonian gravity, say if I do an ADM decomposition. So, and their claim then was that this type of gravity, let me put it in inverted commas, was an action S lambda Einstein-Hilbert, which just generalizes this to general lambda here, does nothing else, everything else is the same, for lambda equal to smaller than 1/3. So that's the case when the Wheeler-DeWitt metric is positive definite, is not attractive. Well, so they mean this literally. I mean, gravity being universally attractive, they say, if I choose this value of these values of lambdas, well, there's something fundamentally wrong with gravity. So what type of argument did they make? What is observable they looked at to try to understand the influence of this little lambda? They looked at kind of the sign. So they weren't actually interested in the value of it, but the sign of the acceleration of the three volume, d3x square root of g. They chose a compact space time, but I think their argument doesn't depend on it in any very crucial way. So three volume. Now, what they computed is exactly the acceleration, d by dt squared v, and the computation they made gave rise to the following result. A prefactor, which no depends on lambda. Here we have kind of the pieces from the potential term in the action appearing, so that's a cosmological constant term, that's a three-dimensional Ricci scalar. So I say a little bit more about how they got there in a second, but let us look at what this implies. They say, look, we know the nature of gravity. It means that a positive Ricci scalar must lead to a negative acceleration. And by contrast, if I have a positive lambda, it leads to accelerated expansion. So this must, in order for these two things to go through as we are used to, this prefactor must be negative, which means that this quotient here should be positive, which means, apparently, that lambda should be larger than 1/3. at the very least, to make sense of gravity with the properties we believe to be correct properties of gravity.
That would not suggest a mathematical inconsistency. Right? There is nothing wrong with the opposite.
No, but
doesn't describe gravity in our universe.
That's right. However, you might argue that it is strongly, in conflict with standard cosmology. So I now point out to an actual inconsistency in how this result is arrived at. So, of course, what is also very interesting, an observable that depends on lambda. So that gives us a handle on lambda. Right? So that is potentially, it's just a very interesting argument.
So, Renata, maybe yes. I just want to repeat what you just said.
Yes.
I think the only way you can actually test lambda is by a cosmology.
I don't know whether you can test lambda, but not this way. So let me tell you why not. So what did they do to obtain? This is a classical computation. They looked at the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is, of course, just, as usual, a linear combination of constraints. Laps times Hamiltonian constraint plus shift diffeomorphism constraint, where, of course, now my H is slightly different than usual. And here comes the real Wheeler de Witt metric, just for you. Pi AB with the indices all downstairs, CD minus square root G3R minus 2 lambda. And this has the usual form. Let me just not write it down. So by taking basically two commutators, the Poisson brackets rather, I get to this acceleration term. And in particular, so using this new Hamiltonian, which has the lambda, not in general, not equal to 1 is in it. Now, the problem is that this contradicts what is called lambda R gravity. Now, that brings me to a topic that hopefully will be covered by the next speaker, Peter Hojava. So for much later than this result appeared, he was the one to suggest to look at generalized types of gravity. And one part of the generalization that was looked at, and that is leads to some kind of a subclass of what is now called Hojava-Lifshitz gravities, are the ones which have a modified kinetic term in the action. I can also have many other new parameters, but let me, if I look at the model that is like GR, but with a generalized lambda, I get to the setting that Giulini and Kiefer use. So let me just finish that argument. And people looked at this lambda R gravity, and they found it's actually completely equivalent with general relativity. In particular, it has two propagating degrees of freedom. How does that come about? Well, one way to see it is to make a careful Hamiltonian analysis of this modified theory and seeing that something new happens when lambda is not equal to 1. The new thing that happens is, and so the analysis I'm talking about in this way is due to Bellorin and Restuccia, paper came out a couple of years ago. So in particular, something happens when you take, of course, H and HI still come out as primary constraints. For consistency, you have to check that the time derivative vanishes. For that, you have to Poisson commute with H. And whenever lambda is not equal to 1, you get a non-trivial contribution from H with H itself. That results in the fact that a further consistency then to check that the time derivatives of the non-vanishing right-hand sides vanish leads you to a couple of second-class constraints. So what happens in this theory, these HIs are still first class, but you get a pair of second-class constraints, H equal to 0, and the new constraint, pi equal to 0. Pi is the trace of pi is, just hang on, let me finish my sentence. Pi is essentially trace k, so it's just a trace of the conjugate momentum. So that's a pair of second class constraints. So as a matter of fact, what this funny kind of kinetic term entailed, which was a kinetic term of the form ABCD, KABKCD, which I can decompose it in this way, minus lambda K squared. So here is my generalized lambda, and suggesting, what happens in this Hojava-Lifshitz style theories is they're only invariant under three-dimensional diffeomorphisms. It allows you to introduce this lambda here because these two terms are separately invariant. Did people want to ask urgent questions before my God? Yes.
Comment, which yes. Is that, according to the standard analysis, which was done starting off by Barbara Foster and O'Murphy
yes.
in 2002. If the
lambda, you mean the Hamiltonian analysis?
Yes, if the lambda is not 1,
yeah.
Then an apparent obstruction arises in the constrained algebra. And that leads in some cases to inconsistent theories. But I showed that one of the factors in the obstruction term, which comes in the number mm-hmm. of factors, one of the factors in that effectively amounts to pi equals 0, or more generally pi over root 8 is constant as a possibility,
yes.
which implies particular slicing theories, in fact, CMC's privileged slice
yes.
theories. And within that option, you have that condition and you have consistency. So all of that was known more or less in 2002, definitely written up by me at least by 2007
okay.
or so.
Okay.
But moreover, according to that analysis, one is willing to reject theories that don't appear to work rather than inventing new principles of dynamics moves to keep.
So okay.
And there, the Dirac principle is used as a means of getting rid of unwanted theories that do not appear to be consistent.
Okay. So. I didn't know about these results you just mentioned. Just they appear to be, so I want to make, I just want to make a specific point, of course, one can talk for ages about this. The specific point I want to make is there appear to be a contradiction. On the one hand, you have an observable that depends on lambda, and you seem to derive, for some values of lambda, unphysical results. Then you have results that say, look, these theories are perfectly fine for any value of lambda. They are gauge-fixed versions of GR, if you like. And as a, so, of course, the variables that appear have a slightly different meaning, right? So, however, it looks on the face of things that, well, at least you cannot immediately reject lambda not equal to 1 for that reason. And what was wrong with the previous analysis, or my way of phrasing what went wrong, the way that my student Louis Piresh came up with, when I told him about this contradiction, was to look at how this was derived. First of all, by Giulini and Kiefer, they were not aware, or they didn't make the calculation of the Poisson algebra, so they didn't notice that the character of the algebra had changed. Secondly, they made an assumption. They put in a gauge choice. They used proper time gauge. So they used n equal to 1 and I equal to 0. And this turns out not to be compatible with this gauge fixing. So you're not allowed to do that. And if you're not allowed to do that, by doing that, you over-constrain your system vastly, which you don't want to do. But if you're not doing that, then their derivation becomes just empty. So they don't have, there is no derivation. So in this sense, there is no contradiction. Yes.
There are two comments on that.
Yes.
One is the Bayer and Stutcher side.
Yes.
The way they did pi equals exactly 0.
Yes.
If that comes into the boundary conditions that they impose at spatial infinity.
Mm-hmm.
So if you had asymptotically something up there, it's like if a W, you would have pi equals some constant that evolves in time.
Yes.
And the other thing is the Giulini-Kiefer thing goes through if you have homogeneous cosmology, because then n equals 1 is just is just the CMC lab.
Perhaps. Certainly it doesn't go through in generality.
No, so in general it doesn't. I agree with
that. You want to say there is actually a lambda-dependent observable I construct in a bona fide manner, and that rules out these series?
It's just that this simple argument, I think, doesn't doesn't show that there is no longer.
No, but I'd love to see one. I'd love to see one.
I wasn't planning to talk about that, but
no, and you're not going to talk about it during my talk.
No, but yes, so yes, you can see it in cosmology, and we've measured it, and it's constant to within a percent or so.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Yes, I also I realized, you know, an updated version of this, that also, you were cited, so you have certainly some part in this story. Can I just wrap up my story because I want more than some? Yes, yes, exactly.
Probably the stupid
yes.
Is that the expression that we just wrote today an equal to zero? Is that the pi equal to zero condition?
This whole thing? No, this is equal to zero.
Just the last.
Yeah. So the trace. Trace case equal to, therefore, you see, all lambda dependence drops out. So nothing, yeah.
I understand that.
So it's difficult, you know, if one is after something lambda dependent, one has to do it slightly differently. Now, let me change trace. So lambda not equal to one, however, is not necessarily a sign of great alarm and that we are not dealing with GR or gravity. It depends on the circumstances. Okay, so that's at least is a warning. Why? Why is this important? Because if you're looking, say, if effective actions obtained for gravity obtained from kind of non-perturbative path integral constructions, then effective actions which have a dependence that have an apparent lambda dependence in them are something we can construct and we can investigate. So if you asked, what can I say about a mode decomposition like that in a full theory of quantum gravity, and that might exhibit something like a lambda dependence, for example, what tools do I have? What do tools currently available for such non-perturbative path integral constructions, what are they able to tell me? The answer is very, very little. So firstly, as a matter of principle, of course, when I imagine I have a description that is working close to the Planck scale to describe my dynamics there, of course, I have absolutely no, this is totally non-smooth in general, but I'm far away from any classical regime, so I have no way to identify components of a metric tensor or paths of components locally, or indeed tangent, even less tangent vectors, because everything is totally non-smooth. So of course, if I wanted to relate to local mode expansions, that I would expect to only work at some intermediate stages where I already have constructed some, reconstructed something like a background geometry, so which might have some approximate metric properties captured by these. Now, however, what I might be able to do is look at certain global modes of the metric, which pertain, well, to the, say, the entire universe, let's say, if it's compact. And this is exactly what has been done. And for example, if I look at not general conformal modes, but a global mode that is a constant mode, then, of course, writing this down, it will still have a dependence potentially on such a G inside it. And of course, that happens if I do classically, if I do a cosmological reduction of my degrees of freedom, and all I'm keeping over is a scale factor. If I write down an effective kind of mini superspace action for the scale factor, and if I work with a generalized real de Witt metric, this term will exactly have a lambda dependence in it. Why? Because what is then zooming in exactly on a mode like that, and not one for general x, but for the ones that depend only on t. So, and of course, the bare action has exactly this property I exhibited here. It will be negative. And you'd say, of course, in the context of cosmology, that's the only, the Friedmann factor is the only thing there is. So you're directly hit in the face with this unboundedness. So let me just very briefly write down what kind of action this is. And I also want to relate, how much time do I have?
Well, time is up.
Time is up. I have had many interruptions.
You have many interruptions. So
okay.
If everybody agrees, we just got a little bit short of the topic.
Everyone is silent because I have a choice. I'm
feeling sad for those who didn't have a copy this morning.
Okay. I didn't have a coffee this morning, so I'm very. I feel intensely sad too. But okay, I think I can wrap up the story to some logical, semi-conclusion. If I have 5 minutes of doing this, so how do I get to such effective actions? Well, I get to there from doing non-perturbative path integral constructions. And of course, I will not be giving you any details, but just to quote to you what is the kind of the Euclidean path integral, you try to determine, I mean, you try to integrate in a non-perturbative approach. And my favorite one is the CDT approach, where you're summing over inequivalent causal spacetimes represented by triangulations. You have a simple measure here. And after recrotating, you just have the retroversion of the Euclidean-Einstein-Hilbert action, which depends on all the geometric data that sit in your triangulation. Now, cutting a long story short, so what is this action? The action depends on coupling constants, inverse Newton constant, and it depends on certain counting variables that count. So such a triangulation is made up of 4 simplices and 2 counts, the sub-simplices that are 2 dimensions, that are triangles, and 4 counts, the top-dimensional simplices, so they contribute to the overall volume. C is some positive constant. Lambda is a cosmological constant. And delta is a certain asymmetry parameter, which appears for generality in the discrete action. So this is, of course, a regularized object, and this counts certain types of four-dimensional simplices. Let me not go into the details of that because I don't have the time. If the building blocks are chosen isotropic in the sense of being equilateral in time and spatial directions, then this delta is zero and you don't have this term. What you find here is this is a statistical system whose properties you try to extract in a limit where the volume becomes infinite. Very long story cut short, one studies this for constant total volume N4, and then the only 2 relevant bare coupling constants that are left in the game are the inverse Newton constant and the cosmological constant, the delta here. We get a phase diagram in the delta K0 plane. We get phases for the system as a statistical system. Only one of the phases appears to be physically interesting. That's a phase C. Then here we have phase A and phase B. And this here is the De Sitter space. So it's the De Sitter phase. In this region, we find in the infinite volume limit that the path integral has the Euclidean path integral has a ground state that has the shape of a De Sitter space. So De Sitter is, we are in Euclidean, is around S4, the four sphere. These other phases seem to have no immediate physical interest. What I want to point out is that the global conformal factor, which is in our system the 3 volume as a function of time, its behavior as a function over time serves as an order parameter to distinguish between those systems. Why is this of relevance? Because V3 of t is exactly kind of a global scale parameter. And if you think of Friedmann factor, this would be proportional to the Friedmann factor cubed, right? Now, an effective mini superspace action is written down, usually in the continuum for this A variable, we can extract an effective action for this V3 from the simulations, because that is something we can easily monitor. And, well, you've seen pictures of our de Sitter universes. The shape as a function of time approximates around S4, whereas here you get highly fluctuating object as a function of time. Now, it turns out that this phase and this phase are the rough behaviors can be deduced from an effective action for this V3. And this generalized effective action is of, well, let me call it Hojava-Lifshitz type. Yes, so what is it? If only I had space, but I haven't. And I don't have time to erase anything. So it's of this, so that's fine, because that will give a natural end to my presentation. I run out of space. So imagine now what I'm de facto doing. I'm integrating over everything. So my path integral contains, well, up to a cutoff, it contains all possible fluctuation. I zoom in on just the dependence on the 3 volume, and I try to extract an effective action for that. And it turns out from computer simulation to look like this. V3 dot squared divided by V3 plus, well, V3 1/3 plus other stuff. I want to emphasize the dependence here. You see, I have a kinetic term, and it turns out the effective action I'm writing down is just the mini superspace action that in the continuum would have S4 as a solution. Now, however, note here, I don't have a minus sign. I have a plus sign here. And that's the only thing that makes sense, because I'm in Euclidean, and the Sitter space I see is a minimum of the effective action. Another way of phrasing it is that what characterizes physics with respect to the scale factor here is exactly kind of a mini superspace action, you could say, of Hojava-Lifshitz type, which has a general kind of lambda dependent prefactor here, V3, plus other stuff whose sign is allowed to vary, and this I can capture by a single constant. Let me just call it lambda. And it appears to be that if I'm in this phase, my other degrees of freedom, the entropy of the path integral, they conspire to yield an effective contribution to that leading kinematic term, which changes the sign of this term and makes it positive definite. Plus some other magic that happens, giving then rise to such a de Sitter solution. Now, what happens if I move around in phase space? If I go, I just did this completely wrongly. This is kappa naught, and this is delta. If I move that way, it means this is essentially the curvature term of the action. This is 1 over g Newton. If I increase this kappa naught, I give more weight to the bare action, including the curvature part of the bare action, including terms like this. So that makes it kind of natural, and this is exactly what you see happening. If I choose by hand a larger kappa naught, this is just a free parameter in my model, I move towards this phase, and eventually what gave me positive contributions to here is outweighed by negative contributions that come exactly from the bare action, and I run into a phase which exactly sees this conformal divergence, and then leads to kind of nonsensical, highly, presumably nonsensical, highly fluctuating universes. So this seems to suggest is exactly what I said here. Quantum contributions can lead to such lambda effects. Now, this raises many a question, which we can talk over about during the coffee break. You know, you could ask, well, does this mean this is a Hojava-Lifshitz type gravity? Well, this is one piece of the puzzle. So, you know, let's let's not get carried away, but it's certainly an interesting, it's an interesting question, which already much more has been written and said about. But I'm definitely at the end of my time, at the end of the Blackboard space, and thank you very much for listening.
So there will be a discussion session in after Nyayesh's talk, and
okay.
We can